I'm Dana Carvey.
I'm David Spade.
Fly on the Wall's back for another season now on audio and video every Monday and Thursday.
So many incredible guests will be joining us.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Too good to be true.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins us every Monday in the 12 o'clock hour, and we appreciate that. Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Guy, let's start off with the Fed, if you don't mind, real quick. Over the weekend, a lot of stories about when did the Fed Chair Powell know about a $2.5 billion renovation of the Fed's offices. How could you do a renovation for $2.5 billion? I mean, it seemed to me you could build a massive complex for that amount of money.
Yeah, I would really question that number. I'd want to dig a little deeper. Now, anything the federal government does is always expensive, and so that's something that we do want to check on. I think this is an example, though, of inside leaks with the idea of undermining Powell's authority. And it's one of those things that happens in Washington. If you happen to be on the other side, if your person on the opposite side of you spends some money, you leak to the press that they're wasting money, they're not going through the right process. Powell only has a number of months left before he leaves as chairman. So it's going to be May of next year. It's unlikely that, he's building a palace for himself. So I suspect that the government architects are designing this, but it certainly looks bad. It's expensive. And as I say, anything in Washington is expensive, but I'd also consider the source and consider that the idea is somehow to discredit him and to push him into doing things that the administration may be in favor of.
Guy, the Fed is something that a lot of folks don't really know a lot about. How big of an organization is that organization?
The Fed, the governing structure is pretty small. You have a limited number of Fed governors. Then you have the regional Feds, like the Atlanta Fed, that regulates banks in our area. So there aren't a tremendous number of people. It also has regulatory authority over national banks. So in terms of headcount, it's relatively small among the federal agencies, but it's tremendously influential because of its role in monetary policy. And the Fed Bank of New York, which is one of the independent Fed banks, institutes all of the purchase and sale of government securities on behalf of the federal government. So tremendously important, relatively small headcount. I've been to the Fed headquarters. I'm with you. I can't imagine how they could renovate it for $2.5 billion. It's actually pretty darn impressive. When I was there, it really did look good, and I'm not sure what exactly they're doing with that money, but we'll have to dig into where the money's actually going.
Yeah, I mean, a renovation of $2.5 billion, I'd just soon tear the building down and start over again.
I'd like to have that money to redo the Superdome. We could start over and make it bigger than Jerry World in Dallas.
Exactly. So let's talk about the new focus on the 10-year Treasury rate by the Fed. What's happening there?
Yeah, the 10-year Treasury is really important. And the challenge for the Fed and the challenge for the administration is that's the rate that is really most important in terms of setting mortgage rates. And we're in a bit of a conundrum for the United States. First-time home ownership is at the lowest level it's been in 20 years. National Association of Realtors keeps track of the average age of first-time home buyers. You know, going back 20 years or so, it used to be in the high 20s. You know, my wife and I bought our first home when we were 24. Now, the average age of a first-time home buyer is 38, which is really shocking. I mean, that's really late, and one of the reasons is interest rates have been high, the cost of a home is high, but there are a lot of downsides to that late ownership. One is most people, their home is their biggest asset, and if you don't buy your house until you're 38, 30-year mortgage, you're not going to pay it off till you're 68. Well, normal retirement is between 65 and 67. So it pushes back retirement options, and it really affects standard of living. The other thing is, because of the big deficit, the federal government is funding a lot of Treasury bills, notes, every month. And the shorter term is where they're funding most of the federal debt. They're not really issuing that much in 30-year and 20-year for a couple of reasons. One, the rates are trending up. They're higher than they have been in the last 3 years. Borrowers are getting nervous about the long-term fiscal status of the U.S. and also the EU and Japan. They're all seeing the same thing. Rates at the long end are going up. So ideally, what the administration would like is for the 10-year rate to come down. That would stimulate home ownership. That really adds to stability in society. It also helps people with wealth creation. It would also help the government, because the most rapidly increasing part of the federal budget right now is the interest on the debt. So pushing that down would really be very important. It's one of the reasons that they're focused on that.
That has been kind of the thing in President Trump's craw, right, is that other countries have been able to do so.
Well, they have and they haven't. I mean, there's some outliers. Switzerland is the most unbelievable. Switzerland's Fed funds rate is now zero again.
Wow.
You know, Switzerland actually at one point got to negative. And that is, as I say, an outlier. Wow, getting bad weather sweeping through.
Yeah.
But the reason Switzerland's rate is so low is that people around the world flock to Switzerland for a stable currency. You know, they feel like the Swiss are managing their budget, so they want to put money in Swiss banks. We normally are a safe haven currency, but people are a bit nervous about the long-term outlook for us. But as I say, Japan's long rates have gone up. The European Union long rates have gone up. And, you know, ours have as well. They're higher than they were 3 years ago. And the long rate is something the Fed doesn't control. That's important to remember. The Fed can absolutely control the Fed funds rate and short-term rates. But the long-term rate is subject to the market. And right now, you don't have enough buyers that have confidence that the rates are going to remain stable for the long term. So it's very hard to sell 30-year bonds, 20-year bonds. And some countries like Mexico actually sold 50- and 100-year bonds. It's inconceivable that we'd be able to issue those right now.
Yeah. All right, we're going to get to a break. We'll pick up this conversation when we come back about tariffs and what's going on there. We'll be right back with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust.
Hey, guys, Fly on the Wall is back for another season. That's right, on audio and video every Monday and Thursday. Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. And, Guy, you have an update on the Fed renovation project.
Yeah, the Fed must be pretty sensitive. They sent a note. They have said that they're overhauling historic buildings built in the 30s, removing asbestos, removing lead contamination, accommodating modern technology, replacing heating, HVAC, fire detection, structural work, and creating public space on the mall. Now, you ask how many people there are. There are 23,000 Fed employees, so that works out to about 108,000 per employee. So I'd suggest it's still fairly expensive. I imagine you could do it for a lot less if you had a private contractor involved, but that's their explanation of why it's so expensive.
Interesting. So they actually have 23,000 employees in the Fed Reserve.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, we were thinking, you know, if we spent that much money per employee, we'd have a Gulf Coast Bank renovation of $108 million. So
I know that's not going to happen at Gulf Coast Bank.
No, we're not going to spend $108 million renovating our buildings.
So, Guy, let's talk about tariffs. I've almost given up on this topic because I just can't get my finger or my head wrapped around where we are. It's changing by the hour.
Yeah, I almost hate to bring it up, but it matters. One of the reasons it matters is stability for business is absolutely important for investment. Now, the first step of stability was passing the tax bill. And look, if I was writing it, I might have changed some things, but it's great to have it done. That adds stability and planning for people on taxes. The next pillar is tariffs. No one is going to build a factory based upon tariffs until they know what the tariffs actually are. So the uncertainty is a problem. The other thing, and this gets back, everything's connected, the Federal Reserve is not going to reduce interest rates until they know what the effective tariffs are. The Fed economists are absolutely convinced they're, without exception, that tariffs are inflationary. So their belief is that if the tariffs go in anywhere near the levels that are proposed, inflation will go up and they will not be able to reduce interest rates. So we get back to that. How do you make housing affordable? You got to solve the tariff issue, preferably as low as possible, and make it certain, because it really creates a lot of problems. And if I were advising the administration, I'd say whatever tariffs you end up with, submit them to Congress for a vote, because if you can change them by presidential whim, the next president may do something different. And if I'm building a billion-dollar factory or something substantial, you know, I need to know for sure that the tariffs are going to last, you know, for the lifetime of the factory, that 30 years or so. So this uncertainty is really causing problems. And right now we've got a proposal of 30% for the EU and Mexico, 35% for Canada, 50% for Brazil, 50% on copper, and then a wild card, which is in 50 days, if Russia doesn't agree to peace in Ukraine, you know, substantial tariffs over 100% on countries that buy Russian oil. So a tremendous amount of turmoil right now. It is disrupting investment decisions, and it also has the Fed on hold.
From a policy standpoint, there has to be kind of a sunset on this issue, right? I mean, when you have to put this issue to rest, I mean, because there is a stalling effect, as you've described, in the economy right now. It's hard to quantify what it actually is, but you know it's there, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, imagine you and I are sitting on the board of a major company looking at a significant expansion that would employ thousands of people. We just can't make that decision until we know for sure what the tariff situation is. So it's really vitally important. Now, the tariffs were supposed to go into effect July 9th, now August, early August. Whatever they might end up being, I would really suggest get that done, just like we did the tax bill. The July 4th deadline became a real deadline, and it happened. But if that certainty occurs, and preferably low, I mean, there's just a lot of evidence that relatively low tariffs are better than relatively high. And, I mean, there's some countries that you may have unique circumstances, but it's important to put this issue to bed and then to decide what you're trying to accomplish. One of the challenges right now is the Brazil tariff is about their treatment of their former president. Well, if we're using tariffs to affect domestic policy, you know, that really creates a whiplash effect, because if they change the policy, then the tariff goes away. If they do a new policy we don't like, it could come back. And I would suggest we ought to use different means to affect domestic policy. And there are a lot of countries that just aren't going to do that. They're going to refuse to change domestic issues because of tariffs. They may change economic issues, but they're not going to want the U.S. dictating what their domestic policy is any more than we would want other people doing that to us.
They can't prostitute themselves, is what I'm trying to say, by doing
that.
Right? I mean, because that's a slippery slope.
And I mean, particularly the European Union, Canada, Mexico, you know, they have to realize, look, we'll negotiate on the economic issues, freedom of trade, but we really can't negotiate on other things and let you tell us how to do our domestic policy.
On this, there are a lot of people that are buying in that the tariffs are not going to have the inflationary impact that folks are nervous about. I'm not buying that yet. I mean, you know, because we really haven't had the big time tariffs that President Trump has talked about. Is your feeling that it's still premature to say that it's not?
I would have to agree with the economists that tariffs are generally inflationary. I mean, there is a tariff theory that if you have a low tariff, around 10%, perhaps as high as 20, that the foreign governments will absorb, not the governments, the foreign exporters will absorb most of it. But once you go beyond that, I don't know of any reputable economic theory that says that they're not inflationary. And an example is the copper tariff and the steel tariff. So the world price of steel is about $440. U.S. steel makers, when we put in tariffs, raised the price of domestic steel because they could. They were protected by a tariff. And, I mean, once again, if I'm running a business and now my competitors have to raise their prices, then I'm going to raise mine and be just a little bit cheaper than them. But I'm still raising my price. So when steel tariffs went in, domestic steelmakers raised their prices. And they're, when you consider employees, there are 80 employees in a steel-using business compared to a steel-making business. So that price increase gets passed on. Copper, we have the proposed 50% tariff on copper. The challenge with doing that, and I understand the logic, copper is an essential mineral, and we need it to make all kinds of electronics. But the idea is that we'll do more mining in the U.S., more manufacturing of copper in the U.S., but that takes a long time to get started. I mean, you can't, with all the will in the world, you can't open a copper mine quickly. You can't increase production quickly. You can't produce electronics-grade copper quickly. It takes years. You've got to go through environmental reviews, permitting, you know, site location, design. And the other challenge is a lot of manufacturers are saying in the background, they don't want to be quoted out loud, said, we're having a hard time filling the jobs we have. You know, not a lot of people want to go into this work. It's pretty hard. I mean, it's physically challenging. You get paid well, but it's tough work. And we're not able to fill every single job we'd like to. If manufacturing were to increase significantly, we're not sure how we would staff it. And if you look at the U.S. manufacturing, our level of employment is essentially the same it was in 2020. So we haven't really gained manufacturing jobs, and we may not have the labor flexibility to do it. So all that to say, if we increase tariffs on essential materials like steel and iron, we may just increase our prices, which would increase inflation, which would cause the Fed not to lower rates, which means a 10-year bill stays high and mortgage rates are high. And that whole daisy chain ends up where you don't want it to be. The federal government has more interest expense, and we have fewer first-time home buyers.
Guy, do you get the sense that this country has evaluated where it should be? And let's just take copper for an example, because I think copper is reported as being the second most used mineral in the world or something along those lines. Do we have a sense of where we should be from a mining capacity in where, you know, it's optimal for us, where we create a balance that we're not going to allow China or others to threaten us with, you know, the amount of copper that they have, where we have enough, you know, how much is enough for us to mine, I guess, for us to not be beholden to others? Do we tend to look at things that way?
We should, and I hope that at some place in the government they're doing a strategic review and saying, look, for these materials, we really need to produce a certain percent, 50, 60, 70%. And, you know, we're going to do what's necessary to make that happen. Copper is mostly coming from friendly countries. You know, Freeport, Mac Moran has a giant copper mine in Indonesia. There are Australian copper mines. They're South American. So it's not coming from China. And, I mean, it's not like the rare earth minerals. And, unfortunately, sometimes we go the wrong direction. We have rare earth minerals in Alaska, in Utah, that we could mine, but federal regulations prohibited mining, and the delays made it impractical and economically unfeasible to do it. So we ended up letting China have a monopoly position, which really puts us over a barrel, and they're using it in their negotiations with us. When they say they're selling us rare earth minerals, they are, but they're selling just a little bit every month. They're sort of milking it out bit by bit to extend their leverage.
Yeah. And I was I just found an article actually in the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about Freeport-McMoRan has started its Safford open pit mine east of Phoenix. I guess it's a copper mine. It's the last one it opened in 2007. It's a long time ago when you think about it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you speak about Freeport. One of the sad things is when we go to our Phoenix office, you have to walk by the Freeport office building, which is in downtown Phoenix en route to the baseball stadium. It's like, son of a gun, I wish they were still headquartered here.
Yeah, no doubt, for sure. Let's go to the big, beautiful bill. Two aspects about all of this. You made this observation before that the most important woman in the District of Columbia right now is the Senate parliamentarian, Elizabeth McDonough. What rulings has she made recently that are creating issues?
Yeah, she has a unique position. She is the Senate parliamentarian. And if you ever watch C-SPAN and you look, she sits immediately on the right. And any bill that comes up, any issue that occurs, the parliamentarian can rule on whether or not it's germane. Her rulings were absolutely critical during the Big Beautiful Tax Bill because she is the one that gets to make the decision on whether or not it fits in and can be used in reconciliation. And just as a reminder for folks, in the Senate, you essentially need 60 votes to do anything. That breaks the filibuster, you carry on. If you don't have 60 votes, you get once a year, you get a shot called reconciliation. And in reconciliation, you can pass things with 51 votes, but only if the parliamentarian rules that they have an economic impact and it's germane to the bill. So she literally has the last word. No one can argue with her. There's no appeal. Her word is law. They have what's called the Byrd BAP, and it goes back to Senator Byrd, where you put each provision through the Senate rules, and she determines, look, this has an economic impact and a fiscal impact, so yes, it can be included, or no, it cannot. And so a lot of the things that were in the bill, a lot of things that were left out, were in her hands. One of the things that was left out was selling federal property. You know, I still think, you know, federal property immediately outside of Las Vegas. There's a lot of it. You know, it's mostly desert. It's very close to the city. We ought to sell it, put it back into commerce. But she gets to make that decision. And the interesting thing is she never makes public speeches. She only makes one public speech a year, and it's to the youth that work in the Senate. So the Youth Senate program gets to hear from her. She does not take questions from reporters, and she doesn't discuss bills, provisions with the senators. She doesn't argue with them. She doesn't fight with them. She just makes the ruling and moves on. So sort of like a sphinx, very quiet, very authoritative, but also very well respected. Harry Reid, John Thune, Mark Warner, people from both sides of the aisle respect her. The Speaker of the Senate, the President of the Senate, who is a Republican right now, could replace her. She serves at the will of the President of the Senate. But both sides of the aisle think that she is doing a good job, that she's calling balls and strikes fairly. So she gets to make an awful lot of the decisions on what goes into the bill, what goes into reconciliation, and then on a normal basis, how the committees function. So, person that you're never going to hear much about because she deliberately stays out of the limelight, but makes a lot of difference in how economics and how policy is done in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it's always interesting, to see how that ultimately works. And I thought she would have been more interactive. But, you know, it's funny, there's not a lot written about the parliamentarian. Yeah, so this is hard to kind of do research on that person, right?
Oh, yeah, and I mean, she does that deliberately. And I actually think she's very wise to do that because if she starts entertaining reporters' questions, that's an incredibly slippery slope and better just to make your rulings and move on. And she's done that. And as I say, she could have been replaced. She could have been replaced by President Biden. She could have been replaced during the Trump administration. But she was appointed in 2012 by Harry Reid. So she has been around for a while. She's gained respect. And as I say, she's the woman that nobody knows but wields tremendous power in Washington, D.C. And apparently very well, graduate of Vermont Law School and, you know, just one of those people behind the scenes that actually makes things happen.
So in the big, beautiful bill, there are some time-sensitive stuff for individuals. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there are a couple that are really important and want to talk about that, particularly if you're interested in buying an electric vehicle. The tax credit, $7,500 for a new car, $4,500 for used, those go away September 25th. So if you have any interest in buying an electric vehicle, you need to buy that electric vehicle before September 25th. And particularly on the used side, prices have plummeted. You know, they've gone down about 30%. A lot of people in California are mad at Elon Musk, so they're selling their Teslas at a discount. They're still wonderful vehicles. And if you put your politics aside, you're picking up a very good vehicle at a very good price. Now the price is around $30,000 for used cars. You know, that's a significant drop from its new price, and you get this tax benefit. The other thing is if you buy a new one, a new EV, whether it's a Tesla or a Cadillac or whatever, as long as it's made in the U.S., you can deduct the interest. So you really end up with two tax benefits. For business.
So how does that work on a $7,500? That's a direct tax credit to what you owe?
Yeah, it's a refundable tax credit, so it can be applied to the purchase price. So you're buying a $75,000 EV, you get to subtract $7,500 from the cost.
And so the interest on the loan.
Really,
interesting.
Yeah, and the interest on the loan on the new ones. You can't do it on the used ones, but on the new ones you can. And so, and I made a mistake. It's September 30th, not the 25th. So you got a few more days.
September 30th. Okay.
But really important to do that. The other thing, and I want to talk to our workers in the hospitality business in Louisiana and anyone else that's listening. In the bill, we have no tax on tips. And that starts immediately. But what's important, and the reason it matters, is it's no tax on tips up to $25,000. And if you do that, and if you report your tip income, you will have to pay Social Security and Medicare, but it will substantially increase your retirement and also allow you to access disability and survivor benefits, which wouldn't be available otherwise. Because what happens now, a lot of people, and look, we have a ton of people who bank with us that are in the service industry that don't report cash tips. And, you know, I remember working for a while as a bartender, and it's possible that the cash tips didn't make it to the IRS. Well, that's illegal, first. But it's also counterproductive now because, as I say, the first $25,000, you're not paying income tax. if you pay your Social Security, you will increase your retirement benefits substantially. So you're basically buying a retirement plan at a serious discount and also making yourself eligible for disability and for survivor benefits. So it's something that people haven't had to do before. They may not be may not have reported those tips, but you can now do it. And the best way is to report it to your employer on a weekly basis. If not, there's a way to report it directly to the IRS. But it's important to do that because it gives you credit if you want to end up buying a home. So you're reporting higher income. It gives you a significantly higher retirement and also the option to the disability. So that's something people haven't done before. This is really sort of eliminates the reason not to. You're still dollars ahead, and I'd encourage anyone in the service industry to go ahead and report the tip. Same thing on overtime. 12.5 of overtime is now tax-free.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, we'll be right back. We're visiting with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Stay with us.
Hey, what's up, flies? This is David Spade.
Dana Carvey.
Look, I know we never actually left, but I'll just say it. We are back with another season of Fly on the Wall.
Every episode, including ones with guests, will now be on video. Every Thursday, you'll hear us and see us chatting with big-name celebrities.
And every Monday, you're stuck with just me and Dana. We react to news, what's trending, viral clips.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.
We're back with Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust, and there are some additional time-sensitive changes for individuals in the Big Beautiful Bill. Guy, tell us about those.
They are, yeah, very complicated bill, and one of the things that is happening is even if you don't itemize and the standard deduction has been increased, it'll go up from 15 to 15,750 for individual, from 30 to 31,500. For a married couple, but you can do an above-the-line charitable deduction. But the change is right now you get $300 per person, $600 joint. Next year it'll be $1,000 and $2,000 joint. So if you're inclined to donate and you're itemizing, you may want to just set that money aside and do two donations early next year because you'll get the benefit of that $1,000 or $2,000 above-the-line tax credit for charitable donations. So that's significant, and that's something people need to think about when they're doing their the tax planning because a lot of folks now take advantage of the standard deduction. The other thing, and it's sort of amusing, when the auto interest deduction is limited to vehicles with two wheels or more. So I guess the Senate wanted to make sure that extensive demand for motorized unicycles and hoverboards was eliminated.
You never know.
Yeah, I mean, who knows why that was in there, but it's in there. Venmo. So imagine you're doing gig work on the side, you're selling stuff on eBay or Venmo, PayPal. Big change, the reporting threshold used to be $600. It's now going up to $20,000. So if you're inclined to do some gig work or some sales on eBay, Venmo, or PayPal, you're not going to have reporting until it crosses $20,000. So that's a great opportunity for people that are looking for some sort of side hustle or something else to do. One of the changes, too, for businesses is bonus depreciation was phasing out. It was 40% this year. It's back to 100%. So 100% immediate expense for equipment and research. But one of the big changes, and this is important for people that are doing manufacturing, qualified property, real estate, is now available for 100% bonus depreciation. Now this expires in 2030. And the reason I mentioned it as being time sensitive is it takes a while to plan things. So if somebody has something in mind, they need to get this done and get it in service before that expiration date. But for the first time, you can actually expense production property, either aircraft production or manufacturing real estate. So That's a big change and something that really does matter to individuals and to companies that are looking at manufacturing.
Let's pivot to our final topic. You and I have talked about this a lot, Environmental Protection Act. A lot of the regulatory stuff has been onerous and crazy to some extent. There are some changes.
Yeah, very positive changes. And look, nobody wants to ruin the air and water. And when the National Environmental Protection Act passed, it had bipartisan support because both parties realized, look, we want to keep the country good. We wanted to make it clean. But what they didn't anticipate was that it would be weaponized by opponents. And opponents to any project can use it to file suit, and the process becomes the stoplight because it's so expensive. And we remember the pipelines that got hung up in litigation. You file litigation after litigation, demand more and more detail, more and more environmental studies, more and more delays, and people give up. You just say, you know, it's not worth the effort. I'm not going to do it. So the Supreme Court ruled that the Environmental Protection Act was not designed to stop projects. So they've reined in the extent of the lawsuits, and the administration has put in administrative procedures, cutting the time frame and saying, look, any objections have to be raised more quickly. They can't be extended forever, and the lawsuits can't be for the sole purpose of just defeating the project without any rationality. So very positive changes, and this is something that people on both sides of the aisle, presidents have complained about. And never forget President Obama saying once when asked about his investments, he said, the problem with the federal government is when you're using federal money and when you're doing federal permitting, there are no shovel-ready projects. Because things he wanted to get done didn't occur during his tenure in office. And a lot of them were delayed. And the interesting thing is, even though President Obama would propose things, environmentalists and groups that were opposed to any development would file suits. So you'd think that your friends would let you get things done, but they didn't.
Well, that's some good positive movement on that front for sure, because you're right. All it did was tie up projects day in and day out, and nothing gets done, and we never could move forward. Guy, as always, thank you so much for your time, your insight. We truly appreciate it. Guy Williams, President, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. Have a great week.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. Check in with Scoot to see what he has coming your way. Stay with us. All right, folks, hope you enjoyed today's show. We covered a lot of material there, and Scoot joins us. He's headed your way. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, today is the day that Easy Rider hit movie theaters, and I think we're going to do album hour in the 3 o'clock hour, where we'll do songs from the soundtrack of Easy Rider as all of our bumper music in the 3 o'clock hour. Such a monumental film, and I remember when I saw it, I was embarrassed that these rednecks from Louisiana shot and killed them just because they were hippies. They had long hair. But really, it's something that seems so trite today, but it was very real back then. Also, a shooting in Kentucky at a church. Two people are dead. State troopers shot. And we'll talk about how MAGA is not backing down.
Scoot's headed your way, folks. Stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Have a great Monday evening. We'll see you again in the morning.
Hey, what's up, flies? This is David Spade.
Dana Carvey.
Look, I know we never actually left, but I'll just say it. We are back with another season of Fly on the Wall.
Every episode, including ones with guests, will now be on video. Every Thursday, you'll hear us and see us chatting with big-name celebrities.
And every Monday, you're stuck with just me and Dana. We react to news, what's trending, viral clips.
Follow and listen to Fly on the Wall everywhere you get your podcasts.